From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
Okay, well, that sounds like the call to begin the Media Project. Welcome. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ira Fussfeld, the retired publisher of the Daily Freeman of Kingston, New York. And over the next half hour or so, we're going to talk about media issues of the week, try to make some sense out of them, maybe try to make some fun out of them. And along for the ride with me is Alan Shartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio, among other things. Good day, Alan.
And good day to you, Ira, and to Judy.
And that would be Judy Patrick, who is the recently retired editor of the Daily Gazette of Schenectady, New York. And she has a new gig. She is now the vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association. Congratulations, and what's that all about?
Oh, yeah. I'm so fortunate. So I left the daily grind. I got out of the trenches, and I'm working for the New York Press Association, which was founded in 1853, it is an advocacy organization for newspapers. And believe it or not, there are more than 700 member newspapers in New York State alone that I will be helping with all sorts of editorial issues, from training to advocacy. It's a really valuable organization that often gets overlooked. And it also, we often overlook just how many newspapers there are in this state.
We are very fortunate in this state because you have the New York Press Association, which you just described. And is that still headed by Michelle Rhee?
It is indeed.
What a great person. And we have the New York News Publishers Association. The one that Michelle is involved with is for the weeklies primarily, and the Daily Association. And that's been headed for years by Diane Kennedy. And they do great work, and they represent us in Albany and offer a lot of resources to the newspapers. I don't know how many other states have as much luck as we do with these two associations.
Well, we're going to have to be very careful with Judy now, because now, you know, she's always played the role of being a defender of newspapers, including when the newspapers don't deserve defense. But now it's going to be worse than ever.
Well, I'm thinking with Judy is now involved with an organization with 700 member newspapers, you treat her awfully nice. Maybe she could try to get your column every corner in the state that it's not in yet.
Ira, you make a very good point.
And there is a broadcast association, too, no?
Yes, absolutely.
Yes, okay. Well, we're mainly interested in the print press here, isn't that right?
That is so Ira.
Yes, yes. Here's something that interests me. I would imagine that the three of us will agree that we don't go into this business of journalism with the goal of being liked. So we're aware that people don't like us. But let me quote from a story from the Associated Press that says, media watchdog Reporters Without Borders says hostility towards journalists is growing worldwide, often encouraged by political leaders, even in democratic countries. The group's annual Global Index of Media Freedom found an overall rise in animosity towards reporters and a drop in freedoms, notably in former Soviet states, but also in countries from the U.S. to the Philippines. The group says many democratic elected leaders, quote, no longer see the media as part of democracy's essential underpinning, unquote, singling out Donald Trump for his media bashing. And it also notes the recent killings of reporters in EU members Slovakia and Malta. You know, I think we know this, but to read it and to think about it, it's just awfully grim to see what's going on, and that our president, the president of the country that's supposed to be the beacon of democracy with its First Amendment, is helping to motivate this position.
I would only disagree with one part of that. You said our president. You can have him.
You know, the story on that report led with a reporter in another country doing a Facebook Live on a protest, and he was shot in the head as he was doing the Facebook Live. We have, you know, memories of during World War II, if the press is very well marked when they're in a war zone. But nowadays, that doesn't give them immunity. And the other thing is, you know, we're in this protected world where the worst that can happen to a local newspaper reporter in New York State may be that the mayor yells at them. But even that is happening more and more frequently. And I agree with Alan. The president is contributing to this, and that really does need to stop.
So the difference is at the national level, we know what it's all about at the national level, but we also see it dribbling down to the local level. We see it in our mail. I guess I'm not active anymore, but I do read a lot of the mail that is generated, particularly on Facebook and other places, and you constantly hear the refrain of fake news, fake news, fake news.
Well, Ira, I'd like to just repeat a story I've told on this program one too many times, and I'm sure you'll both agree. But I once went to a service organization. At the time, actually, Mario Cuomo was the governor, and they said, "Why does Mario Cuomo keep picking on the press? What's wrong with him?" And I said, "Okay, everybody in this room who's had something to do with the press in the last year, hold up your hand." They all did, because they were all movers and shakers. And then I said to them, "Okay, take down your hands if they got it right." No hands went down. Okay, so there's a perception that we don't do our jobs well enough.
Well, the three of us have been interviewed, no doubt, by media other than our own. And I know, in my experience, I have never seen a story about me that I thought was accurate. Now, now that didn't mean that they were wrong. It just it didn't meet the way I would have painted the picture of myself or my organization. But I know from being in the business that there are nuances, and it's not always going to be the way you want it to be. But when you hear it described as fake news and fake sources by the president and now by leaders of governments large and small, it injects to the reading public, to the general public, a dye of skepticism well above what ought to be skepticism about what they hear on the radio or read in newspapers.
Well, don't get me wrong. You know, what Trump is doing to the First Amendment, or trying to do to the First Amendment in this country, is nothing short of disgraceful. It really is. But I also think that we have to be very careful about who we hire, how in-depth they can go, what they know, what their level of knowledge is, because, you know, those things can really make a big difference. I know Judy, who is, for all of these years, was the editor of this very important newspaper, the Schenectady paper. I am sure that if we had a secret camera on her when she was reading some of this copy, that she would have been not always happy.
Right. Journalism is imperfect. In every story, the people interviewed will probably question. I agree with Ira. I've been interviewed, and things don't turn out exactly the way you'd like them to. But in the past, I think our readers have accepted that when we make the typos, because the overall contributions that the paper or the media organization is making compensates for that. I think imperfection has been accepted in the past, but as I used to tell reporters, you've got to get the name right, because if you get it wrong, they're going to question your accuracy on every other aspect of the article.
In many ways, it's harder in smaller publications because so many of the readers are familiar with either the people or the places that your local newspaper is writing about. And if there is a mistake, just a basic mistake, it will throw into question the accuracy of the entire piece.
Well, that's right. And one of the things that bothers me so much when I see it all is the idea that, you know, we're making corrections now, and I don't want to name a specific big newspaper about this, but there's nuance. You know, is the article correct in terms of what it's basically presenting? And then there are, you know, factoids. So it's always amazing to me to look down at the corrections and say, it's Alan S. Chartok, not Alan W. Chartok. Mm-hmm. We apologize for that.
Yeah. Well, you know what? There may be nuances to the corrections page, but we all remember the day when corrections in newspapers were non-existent. When I started in the business in the early 70s, if the city desk got a call saying there was a mistake in the paper, everybody would, of the editors then, would just sort of shrug their shoulders. You would not see that correction, or you might see it buried somewhere in the back.
You know, it's this whole issue of trust that we're all focused on in the media. But I also think there's an issue of basic respect. That seems to be what we're losing nowadays. And I think if we work harder on building the trust, maybe the respect will come back. But the respect isn't going to be completely back unless you get people at the upper levels of government who will respect what the press does. I'm telling you, at the local level, mayors that I dealt with, supervisors, assemblymen, senators, even governors, they have respected the institution of journalism. The criticism is something new in my mind.
You know what, Judy? That wasn't respect. That was fear. But I do want to say that That's why we in the radio business are so much better than what you guys do.
Oh, man.
Well, I'm going to tell you why. Because we put a microphone in front of somebody's face, and they say something. And then you hear that on the air most of the time. As opposed to you guys who have to have somebody writing down what somebody says and supplying the nuance, don't you see?
Well, come on now. If it's a live interview, certainly it's going to be unfiltered when it reaches the ears of the public. But if it's an interview that has been done in advance or a story that a reporter is out on with a microphone, the process is no different than what it is in print. The broadcast reporter listens back to the quotes, decides what's valid and what isn't valid, and decides what to use and not use. And I'm not saying that's bad, but don't tell me that broadcast is unique because of that microphone.
I call Bushu.
Me too, because if you just report what they write, then you're nothing more than a stenographer.
Yeah, well, that's the problem, because the person who is doing it is the filter. The reporter is the filter. Now, if the reporter comes from a liberal household or a conservative household, the filter might go in one direction or another. Don't you see?
Well, we spend years and years and years trying to work on that filter, so those biases at least get put aside when they produce the radio program or the newspaper article.
I'll meet you halfway.
Yeah, I feel so sad when I hear Alan takes the other side on this, because Alan, as I think we'll all agree, is not Donald Trump. And when Alan is skeptical of the press, people are perhaps more likely to listen and believe that criticism.
Oh, it's my fault. Now it's my fault.
You know, good strategy, Ira.
Now it's my fault. Hey, I come to this program because I think all sides need to be said. But with that said, I have to think that Donald Trump is a big problem in this country. Here's why. About 33-34% at least of the people will say, no matter what he does, he said I could kill somebody on 42nd Street and nobody would care. I think that group doesn't care. And I think if he says a pox on the press, they all go around and say a pox on the press.
Well, there's one thing that we can say favorably about Trump and the Trump administration. In some corners of the media world, despite his fight against the media, ratings and circulation are as high, if not higher, than they've ever been. The big newspapers like the New York Times and the Washington Post are selling a record-breaking number of subscriptions online. Ratings are up on the cable networks. I don't know. How do you want to explain that? I for one, feel an obligation to watch, and I'm interested in it. On the other hand, there's a point in time with whether I say, geez, that's too much. I'm turning it off.
Ah, you know, I love Judy's new job. I think that's great. I want to go back to that if I can. Because these little papers, the little papers which you represent, and some of them are bigger, some of them are smaller. Obviously, Judy, have to hire not the people that the New York Times would be hiring, but often right out of college and other places. So how do you know when they're ready for prime time? And a lot of these people write 4 and 5 stories in one paper. They don't have that many people working for them. Defend yourself.
First of all, let me clarify about the representation in the New York Press Association. There are some big papers in the some of the weeklies on Long Island down in the city, they reach a very large audience, and they're doing some wonderful journalism that, you know, does get overlooked because they're someplace else in the state and you don't tend to think of them. We also have dailies in our membership. The Daily Gazette's one of the members is the, you know, the Post Star. So there are hundreds of papers, thousands of journalists, all doing really good work. A lot of that good work is what the New York Times, the Washington Post, the bigger papers build on when they do these stories that get broader exposure because they're in the New York Times and they're with national distribution.
But they hire your people after you've done the hard work and train them. In other words, somebody comes out of college, and we have a paper here in my hometown that is just one step away from the worst, disgrace. And they hire young people, and then sooner or later, those people get used up and have objections to the way they're being handled. And they take a job at a bigger, better paper like the Berkshire Eagle, for example.
Yeah, you know, I'm okay with that. It's part of our industry is an ambitious reporter will move from one paper to another. You know, you get some great reporters that want to stay in their hometown and do great work all their lives. They're not after the big name and the huge audience. So
we used to have an editor at my paper in Kingston who ultimately went on to larger newspapers. And he would say, people are not sitting around the newsroom of the Washington Post saying, I hope I get a job at the Daily Freeman someday. I mean, I want to get back to Alan's point. I just do want to remind listeners who have just tuned in that you're listening to The Media Project. I'm Ira Fussold with Alan Shartek and Judy Patrick. Regarding the younger people who are coming into the business, sadly, there is a suggestion that even that is being threatened because student newspapers are having more or less the same kinds of financial problems that are occurring with the big professional organizations. And the issue, as always, is money. And the question, among others, is if the student newspapers are not able to generate money on their own, are they going to have to seek help from the administration, the college administrations? A, will that help be there? And B, will that lead to censorship because it would make the administration the de facto publisher with a veto power, which they might employ if there are stories about the university or college that they don't like? Alan, you were involved forever. Still are. With the Legislative Gazette here in New York. What do you think about it? Are you seeing that?
Well, there's no question. I started the Legislative Gazette along with a lot of really good people and had a professional editor. It wasn't student run. But eventually, it cost so much to buy the newsprint and have it printed that we went online. And so far, we're very pleased. A lot of people are going to Legislative Gazette to get their news of state government. So I think things are changing all right, but I think they're changing for everybody.
When it comes to hiring reporters in my old job, one of the first things I looked at was, has the person worked at the college newspaper? And we found great success with every candidate we hired who had worked at the college newspaper because it shows a commitment to the profession and they demonstrate a work ethic and knowledge of the industry you don't get if you don't work at the newspaper.
Yes, and that really leads to another very big and important thing. We're talking about the failure and the successes of newspapers. But the failure and success of colleges is also at stake here. If somebody comes in and you hire that person and has never heard of the lieutenant governor of New York State or knows nothing about Boss Haste at the assembly or one of those people, at what point can you give them a four-year college education when they get to the newspaper?
When I was involved with the college paper at the State University College at the time at New Paltz, when I first joined that newspaper, there was an advisor from the administration who ran the newspaper, in effect. And now remember, this was the 60s, when a time of change and independence among students. We essentially got rid of the advisor and took on the newspaper for ourselves. And we generated the revenue through advertising, but we were not beholden to an administration, even if it was only in title. And I think that that was more or less when that was going on elsewhere in the country. So this concern is we may be going back to that if the college's newspapers have to seek money from the administration.
Ah, those were the days, my friend. You know, come on, give me a break. What you said there is so important, Ira, and that is you generated the money through advertising.
Yeah.
The advertising market is failing because you can't make as much online as you could in a print paper. And that, by the way, Ira and Judy, is as true with student newspapers as it is with, you know, grown-up newspapers.
Well, you could almost argue more so because college students have no history of reading print publication. So even if there's a stack of the college newspaper sitting there for free outside of the Student Union building, there is not an ingrained feeling that I need to pick up this newspaper. And if there's something I want to read, I'll read it on their online site.
Yeah, you know, and even if you get the student newspapers funded through some mechanism, through a student activity fee, you're going to have the obligation front to perhaps paint the student government in a better light than it needs to be all the time.
Alan, you mentioned the cost of newsprint, which is significant for newspapers. I want you to put on your cynics hat or your conspiracy theorist hat.
Who me?
Who you? The tariffs that have been imposed in Canada by the Trump administration have resulted in a tariff on the cost of newsprint, which most newspapers still buy from Canadian mills. And thus, the newsprint prices have gone up roughly 30%.
Wow.
Now, newsprint is historically the number two expense that a newspaper publisher faces after payroll and benefits, etc. The next major expense is the newsprint. And one newspaper publisher at the Tampa Bay Times in Florida says that the tariffs have added an additional $3 million in expenses that the paper can't absorb. So here comes the conspiracy.
I get it.
Get it or I take it.
One in one makes two. Trump hates Trump hates the newspapers. On go the tariffs. Right.
Certainly looks that way, no? If it walks like a duck, et cetera.
So what's this going to mean is less news? Its papers are going to start cutting pages, maybe cutting days that they publish. It's going to hurt especially smaller papers.
And it's going to mean people. This is $3 million at the Tampa Bay Times, which is a fairly good-sized newspaper. The larger papers, it's going to be much more than that. And the smaller papers will be less in dollars, but nevertheless, a 30% increase in their expense budget, which they can't currently absorb. It could do two things that we're already heading to. One is more newspapers closing, or perhaps more likely as an interim step, more daily newspapers reducing the number of days that they publish from, say, 7 to 5 or to 4.
You know, it's odd that Tampa's already dealing with this because the tariff really isn't finalized until later this summer.
Well, you know, we newspaper publishers are very smart, and we have already probed them. If they know what it is right now, and they know what it's going to project to, and they need to stay 2 or 3 steps ahead of that and do whatever they're going to do now before it really does hit them hard in the wallet. So.
Well, of course, nothing that Trump says means anything because, as we all know, he reverses himself a lot. And he's been doing that on the tariffs. He goes up, somebody comes down, there's a visit, Trudeau comes down, they sit there, somebody kisses somebody on the cheek, as we saw with the French premier. You know, don't put it in the bank until he's finally made up his mind.
Right, and this is all advanced by one newspaper mill in the state of Washington. It's not like there is a huge American newsprint industry anymore. A lot of those plants have closed, and they're not going to reopen.
That's right. The newsprint plant in Washington was suggesting that the plants in Canada have an unfair advantage. Thus, the tariff was required to make it a more level playing field. But the long-term result is not going to be good for our industry. Alan, you made reference to politicians being afraid of the newspaper. I have to give credit, even if it's only lip service, to the mayor of the city of Denver, who has come to the fore and spoke up in favor of the Denver Post, more specifically the Denver Post staff and the idea of the Denver Post being an independent, robust newspaper, which it is currently decreasingly so because of the cuts that have been put in place by its owners, whom we discussed the last couple of weeks,
well,
the Alden Hedge Fund.
Well, I call self-serving.
Self-serving on me or the mayor?
On the mayor.
Okay.
You know, the mayor knows where his bread and butter are. He wants to be well covered by the newspaper. He doesn't like the philosophy of the hedge fund who owns it. What does he have to lose? What, he's going to defend the hedge fund?
Well, he's already been criticized heavily prior to this by the newspapers. So for him to have stepped up in face of that, you can't imagine Trump doing that, can you?
No.
On the face of it, you do kind of welcome that level of support. But the editor of the Denver Post is probably cringing because the last thing an editor wants is a lot of praise from a politician they cover.
And I'm hearing last night as we speak that the editor of the Boulder, Colorado paper, which is also a paper within this Alden group, is no longer employed there, he having written a critical article about that hedge fund. And the details are still emerging, but that's a scary conclusion to that, if it is the conclusion to that newspaper. You know, one thing, we have a minute left. Last week, because we got involved in the Pulitzer Prizes and in the Alden story, we didn't talk about Sean Hannity. Let's just do it briefly. I think we know what we're all going to say, but you recall that Sean Hannity's name came up as the third client of Trump fixer Michael Cohen. And Hannity is sort of scoffing over it. It's not a big deal. He only helped me on real estate. But the main criticism that I'm hearing about, and I think rightly so, is that Hannity never disclosed in any of his commentaries pro-Trump, pro-Michael Cohen, that he was, in fact, a client of Michael Cohen.
A clear violation of journalism ethics and the fact that his network is doing nothing about it.
Yeah,
is a travesty.
I could take a cheap shot and say journalistic ethics, isn't that a oxymoron?
Oh.
But I won't.
Well, Hannity himself, depending on the day of the week, has said he is a journalist and he is not a journalist. So he only plays something like that on TV. We're out of time.
No.
We are. Alan Chartok, thank you very much. Judy Patrick, thank you very much. I'm Ira Fussfeld, and thanks to all the listeners for tuning in. We'll see you next week on The Media Project.
Actors upon a living stage now. Newspapermen are such interesting people. when they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild, got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill, all together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such a...
The Media Project is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Alan Chartok is CEO of WAMC, professor emeritus at the State University of New York, commentator, columnist, and author. Rex Smith is editor of the Times Union. And Ira Fussfeld is the publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman. You can listen to or podcast The Media Project anytime at WAMC.org or just download the WAMC app for your iPhone or Android at the Play Store today. Thanks for listening.
Working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.